You're listening to a feed of the Association of Music Podcasting at musicpodcasting.org.
G'day, I'm Merc, and welcome to episode 150, that's right, 150 of Merc FM. It's Tuesday, it's interview day, and I have a very, very special guest that I'm honoured to have on Merc FM for episode 150. Her song, Sincerely Fearful, last year was the Merc FM earworm for the second half of 2010. She's been described as one of the top 10 performers to keep a lookout for in 2011 by the New York Post. She's not even a week out from her latest tour. What can I say? Hello, Emma Dean.
Hello, Merc. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. How are you?
I'm really well. Thank you.
Now, as this episode goes to air, you're only a couple of days out from your latest tour. Are you excited?
Oh, really excited and nervous, but I'm always nervous anyway, so that's nothing new. I'm celebrating the launch of my new single called Something They Can Hold, and I've just released the film clip for it. Yeah, it's very exciting.
So, for the Australians listening, of course, all the details are on your website, emmadean.com, but you're not just restricting yourself to the big centres, you're going around, basically it's an East Coast tour.
Yeah, I'm also, I'm going to a few places that I haven't been for a little while, visiting Toowoomba, in Queensland, and also Adelaide. I've got two shows in Adelaide, actually. The first will be part of my Something They Can Hold tour, and the second one will be performing Stripped as part of the Adelaide Cabaret Fringe Festival. And Stripped, as you know, is a one-woman show that I performed in Sydney at a little venue called El Rocco's, which you came to, Merc.
Yes, I did. That was a lot of fun. So you'll be in Katoomba, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Toowoomba and Adelaide. So you can find all the information, booking information, etc. Via the website emmadean.com. So what sort of preparation goes into a tour such as this? Because this is a new show for you.
Yeah, it is. So 2010, I brought along my imaginary friends on most of my tours, and my imaginary friends were, of course, three physical theatre performers who acted as different facets of my imagination, and they, you know, danced on stage with me and acted and did all sorts of weird and wonderful kooky things. However, this next tour, I've had to leave the imaginary friends at home, and instead I'll be joined by Franz Arp, who's a Sydney performer who will also be supporting me for a lot of the shows, and also my brother on drums, Tony Dean. And this show is really an exploration of my dark side. So I'll be singing a lot of the songs that are, I guess, a little bit, they fall under that dark cabaret genre that I love. Yeah, it'll be a completely different thing.
So how long have you been preparing for the show, as in you're rehearsing choreography and everything like that. How long does that process for you take?
Well, there's not much choreography because I don't have any physical theatre kind of element. For this particular show, we've been rehearsing now for about a month, and then probably for 2 months before that, I was sort of getting the concepts in my little head. Well, actually, it was before that, because often with these shows, you have to send out press releases and you have to send descriptions and have posters and have promo already before you actually start rehearsals. So you kind of have to be solidifying the idea really quite far out from the actual tour. So that's kind of interesting. It's a bit backwards. Probably about 3 months before the tour, I start to really get my set list together, choose the songs that I like to perform, start thinking about a theme, figuring out who I want to take on tour. And so it's a lengthy process. And then about a month of sort of rehearsals, maybe once or twice a week. So that's it.
And then, of course, you've got all the logistics of getting accommodation in the various places, to the various places.
Yeah, I'm really, really anal, Irk. Like, I have a I write out an itinerary for all my band members, and I include the worksheets, and I'm very organized. It's because I think I've sort of had to be. I don't have a manager. I have a wonderful agent, Harbour Agency, and they help with a lot of that stuff. But as I'm managerless, I tend to kind of have to do it all myself, which is, fine and great, because I'm, I guess a little bit of a control freak at times. But yeah, so it is. It's a lot to think about, many layers, and many things that I guess go unseen, in terms of putting together a big tour.
Especially when you consider, for instance, on May 27 you're in Melbourne.
Yeah.
May 28 you're in Brisbane.
Yeah.
And then June the 3rd, you're in Toowoomba, and then June the 4th, you're in Adelaide. You're sort of crisscrossing all over the place there.
Yeah, pretty much. We, I'm really, really lucky to have some good friends and family in most of the places that I'm going to, so I get to stay on their couch or in their spare room. And, I'm just really lucky to have those people in my life who understand, what it's like to be a touring musician. Certainly there are a lot of sort of early morning flights, late night shows, and then early morning flights. So we kind of, end up doing shows with very little sleep the night before, which is a challenge. But you've just, I guess, got to make sure you're staying on top of things like eating healthily and not drinking very much alcohol and not straining your voice and it's a busy time.
Because all of that's also important, and also I suppose when you land in a new city you sort of get a new energy, because quite frankly the people who are seeing you that night, they don't care about what you did the night before.
Yeah, that's it. It's like, it's like they're seeing the show for the first time, and it may be, the fifth time that you've done it on consecutive nights or something, but you do have to really look after yourself and give the best performance that you possibly can. You're right in saying that, when you enter a new city, it's a different energy. And I find that especially Melbourne audiences are so totally completely different to Brisbane audiences or even Sydney audiences. And so it's like, you have to sort of gauge how far you're going to take things, or if you've got to ham it up, if you've got to put more energy into it. You kind of gauge that within the first couple of songs and you cater to your audience. But it's quite fascinating, being on stage and really seeing or feeling the different energy from audiences in different cities around Australia. It's quite fascinating, yeah.
So that's a thing that you really have to consider, the different audiences. So it's basically the same show, but how you interact with the audience.
It's different, yeah. Yeah, totally. And some songs, you know, that are like massive hits in, you know, say Brisbane, where my little fans, you know, scream at, may be considered to just totally over the top and weird in other places and like inappropriate as well. Like when I was doing a tour with Dale Thorburn, who was the original Dr. Dream. Originally, he played a character called Gwenda, who used to wear a tutu. And so we'd find that, you know, in some more conservative cities, having a man dressed in a tutu prancing around the stage flashing, you know, kind of didn't work. But so you'd kind of just have to, yeah, just play it by ear and be smart with those kind of choices.
So you're a Brisbane girl. Do you find a massive difference when you get home to Brisbane?
Yeah, of course. Like, you know, I've spent 26 years really in Brisbane building a following. Well, I haven't spent 26 years building a following, but a large portion of my adult life was spent in Brisbane. You know, really, building an audience there And so, of course, when I go back, most of the bigger crowds are in Brisbane. And I do a lot of all-ages shows in Brisbane, which is so wonderful because I have a beautiful following who are under 18 years old. So, you know, and they're always the ones that have less inhibitions and kind of, you know, will scream and cheer and chant. And I even had recently... at a festival called the Friends of Folk Festival, I performed a set with my imaginary friends, and we've got a song called Bigger Than You, Bigger Than Me, which I usually do like a little breakdown to, and I have a little whistle, and we do this kind of military-style dance. And as I was doing that, we broke into the dance, the imaginary friends and myself. I looked out to the audience, and there was a group of about 15 young girls who had learnt the dance.
Oh, no.
And were doing it. And I was just, I mean, it was just such a highlight to see something like that. They'd gone to the trouble of learning the dance, but not only that, like getting together and practicing and, you know, and that was all for me. And it was just, you know, a really mind-blowing thing to experience.
Now, as I know, you also like it when your audience members dress up.
Yeah, you're into that, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Dracula. I do. I love, actually, it all started when I saw a performer from New York called Taylor Mack, who I saw him at the Brisbane Powerhouse. This was about 3 years ago, I'd say. And in his show, he calls himself a drag queen, and he kind of, but, you know, when you think of a drag queen, you think of these sort of very glamorously made up men with, you know, feather boas and all impeccably kind of dressed and look almost better than, you know, women do.
Yeah.
But Taylor Mack was the kind of drag queen that would just, you could imagine him just kind of going into the fancy dress shops and picking out the most ridiculous outfit you could imagine, and he had these tattered red wigs that he kind of would wear and multi-colors that just clashed, and you know, it was just outrageous. But at the end of his show, he actually sang this song, which I sang in Stripped, called There's Nothing to Fear But Fear Itself, which was a very moving song for me to hear. And then right at the end, he said, next time you come to my show, I want you to be colourful. I want you to wear whatever you feel like wearing, and let's create something beautiful, you know? And that to me was very moving, because as someone that's sort of grown up really caring about what other people think of me and really worrying about what other people think of me, to have someone say, wear whatever you want to wear and be whoever you want to be, you know, spoke volumes to me. And so at my shows, when I'm on stage, that's my time to just, you know, be who I want to be, wear what I want to wear. And I like to encourage my audience to do the same, so we can create this safe, you know, sort of haven where there's no judgment, and where we are embracing each other's imperfections and, you know, and embracing each other's differences. And so, for, you know, when you came to the show dressed in your Dracula costume, it was just beautiful. And so many people commented, like, oh, my God, that's such a great costume, you know. I love it. I love looking out and seeing all the different colours, you know. So, I just love it.
So if anyone ever gets to see Emma live, dress up.
Or dress however the hell you want to dress.
Yeah.
Be who you want to be and scream if you want to and... yeah, jump up and down and learn bigger than you, bigger than me dance. Or not.
Or whatever. So the Imaginary Friends tour, I saw it a couple of times in Katoomba and also in Sydney. That was an absolutely awesome show. What sort of preparation went into that? Because you've got dances as well. That would have been massive.
Well, you know, it spans back to the December 2009, where we performed the Imaginary Friends show for the first time at Woodford Folk Festival with a completely different set of Imaginary Friends. Dale Thorburn, as I mentioned earlier, Gemma Contini and Jamie Kendall, all from Brisbane. So, you know, obviously we had like a set of about 10 songs and they choreographed those songs. And then, of course, a few months later, you know, I decided that I was moving to Sydney. So then, you know, a new challenge formed. Shit, what am I going to do when I'm in Sydney? Should I, you know, fly my Brisbane Imaginary Friends all the time to gigs, or is it going to be easier in the long run to train up a new group of Imaginary Friends? I decided on sort of plan B. So I sent out an email to anyone that I knew and a call out for auditions, and I held auditions for these Imaginary Friends and eventually found Amanda Lang, who plays Gigi, Walter Davis Hart, Dr. Dream, and Leah Reutens, who plays Henry, so a female Henry as opposed to a male Henry in Brisbane, which was completely different. Anyway, so that actually training them up and learning the dances, that took a couple of months. And then, of course, there was the new challenge of, well, we've got to kind of create more dances as I write more songs. So it's really been an ongoing process. And, of course, one that's, as you can imagine, quite difficult to sustain, because there are many challenges to having that amount of work, when sometimes, you know, you get offered gigs like with a week's notice. You know, and so I've kind of got to, like, the Imaginary Friends are still running and still going, and there are gigs when, you know, I will happily perform with the Imaginary Friends because it's such a fabulous show and they're such incredible performers. But as a, you know, to be, I guess, smart as a performer and economical, I sort of have to have, you know, a solo show on the run and also just a straight band show as well. So in my head at any one given moment, there are a few shows that are sort of like floating around. It's a matter of kind of choosing for which tours and which gigs which show would be appropriate. So it often feels like it's going to explode. But that is one of the challenges I am learning to overcome.
So there is a possibility of the Imaginary Friends coming back somewhere near you.
Oh, yeah, of course. But another challenge is that Dr. Dream from Sydney, Walter Davis Hart, is actually going overseas. So I now actually don't have a Sydney Dr. Dream, which of course poses all sorts of different challenges. And Dale, who is Dr. Dream in Brisbane, is such a wanted man that he is pretty much booked up for the entire year. So as you can see, you know, doing this next tour without the imaginary friends was sort of one of the only options that I had. Having said that, the tour that we've created is really quite exciting and very theatrical, incredibly theatrical, over the top, ridiculous. Yeah.
So for the benefit of the listeners who haven't seen the show that we're talking about, briefly describe each of the cast members and how they relate to you, because they're all a little part of you.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so the Imaginary Friends troupe that I tour with are three trained actors and physical theatre performers that perform as three different facets of my imagination. Firstly, we have Dr. Dream, who plays a big role, obviously, in my latest album, which is called Dr. Dream and the Imaginary Pop Cabaret. And Dr. Dream is the part of my imagination that's very analytical and incredibly judgmental, particularly judgmental about myself. We have Henry, who is my disturbed imagination, and that's the part of my imagination that finds itself drawn to the dark side, drawn to the little, all things naughty and sexy and addictive. And then there is Gigi, who is my sensual imagination, who is actually quite a comedic character, because often my sensual imagination wanders to the most absurd and almost awkward places. And she's kind of, her character is kind of like a washed up old biddy who's still thinks she's really sexy.
Yeah.
It's had, like, you know, one too many sessions of Botox or something like that. And so, yes, they, that's sort of the three facets of my imagination that I explore in the show.
And then, of course, for your Sydney show that I saw, you also had your brother Tony on drums in a nurse's outfit, in the surgical scrubs.
That's right. And for this show coming up, we've presented it as the first half being a wedding. I'm actually marrying my heartbreak. And the second half is a funeral where I sort of give in to my dark side, and I am no longer. And Tony, for this one, plays a priest, Reverend Tony Dean. And I enter in a maybe I shouldn't spoil it, but I enter in a bride's costume, and then in the second half, there's a costume change, and I have a mourning kind of, you know, that black, very dark, gothic costume. So it's going to be, as I said, just as theatrical, with less dancing, but,
Because the dancing in the previous show, there was a lot of dancing, and I always will remember how you came out onto the stage, first of all, blindfolded and in a straitjacket.
Yeah.
I was waiting for you to fall off the stage.
Yeah, I know. And it was actually really scary in Sydney. It was the first time I did it. And for whatever reason, because usually I had the blindfold so that I could see through it, because it was kind of like a sheer material.
Yeah.
But in Sydney, for whatever reason, the lights were shining in such a way that I literally could not see anything. So I was just kind of going, oh my God, like, just hold it together, Emma, hold it together. It's going to be okay. You're in the right place. You're not going to fall off the stage. But I had no idea where I was. So that was really scary. And then in the Katoomba show, my blindfold just fell off. So, you know, there's always costume malfunctions and things, but that's all part of live performance.
Do you get to have a look at the venue beforehand and work out, for instance, how big is the stage, how much room you've got to work with?
No, not usually. Yeah, so it's like once we actually had to perform at a venue called the Butterfly Club, which is an amazing venue in Melbourne. However, the stage is like this, you know, it's suited for one, maybe two people. And we had four people with the piano on the stage. And so, I mean, we had to actually change the entire choreography to fit the stage. It was just like unbelievable. So yeah, sometimes we just have to work with it, and I've been so blessed to work with these performers from Brisbane and Sydney who are so trained and so like world class that they just kind of go, oh, okay, we've got to change this, and they just do it. It's amazing. Whereas like I get quite like panicky.
Yeah.
You know, but they're just so, so amazing, and work under such pressure really, really well. So we just kind of make it work.
So but, it's the day of the show. What sort of preparations do you put in?
Usually I'll sort of get up, I'll have a bottle of scotch, packet of ciggies, no. I'll usually try and have a chilled out day, but often I can't, you know, often I'll be working or teaching, but I try and talk very little. I make sure I eat really well, you know, it's really good to have energy when you're performing. Drink lots of water and try to do a little bit of, not meditation, but just quiet time where I'm just reflecting. And before I go on stage, putting on my makeup is a lovely ritual that I have, which I just kind of try to do it in a really relaxed way, and just that's my time. And I think it's really important for me to just have my time before I go on stage, so I can go over lines and I can, you know, just feel good about myself and feel good about the show. And then it's really important for me to get the team together, whether it's the imaginary friends or my musicians, Franz Arp and Tony, and have a little group hug, you know, and just say, hey, we're in our element.
We're going to do this, yeah.
We are born to do this. And I have to remind myself that too, because I get incredibly nervous, Irk. Like,
yeah.
I get nervous to the point of shaking and feeling sick and, you know, really nervous. Every single gig, like, it's just ridiculous sometimes. you know, always trying to, you know, control those nerves and not let the nerves control me, you
and
know?
Must imagine that you must find it difficult not to talk on the day of a gig because...
What are you saying? Did I talk a lot? Yeah, I do. I do find it hard. I do find it hard. I use a lot of sign language, fake sign language, yeah. Just, you know, interpretive dance.
Do you have any superstitions like lucky socks or anything that you got to do, and if you don't do it, you're like, oh my God, I didn't do this, I'm going to suck?
Yeah, I've got to like turn the light switch on like four times, and I have to wash my hands three times, and then I have to do six sets of squats. And no, I don't. I actually don't at all. I really should. I feel like sometimes I should have a little lucky, I don't know, bear or lucky pair of undies that I wear, but I don't. I think for me, one of the things that I do is just try and go through the show in my head. When I don't do that, I often find I'm a little bit scatty on stage.
Yeah.
So that's just my little ritual that I do. But in terms of an object, no.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your songwriting, because of course you're not just a performer, you're a singer-songwriter as well when it comes down to it. I'll ask the standard IRC FM singing songwriting question first. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, you're asleep, and you have a really great idea for a song. What does Emma Dean do?
I'd probably just go back to sleep.
Yeah.
Because I remember really, really early on, I went to a songwriting workshop with a guy called Nick Phillips, I think in Brisbane. One of the things he said was that, look, if you've got a melody and, you know, you've written it out or whatever and you can't remember it the next day or you don't have an urge to go and sing it the next day, then it's probably not worth it. And for whatever reason, whether that's right or wrong, you know, I think it's different for different people, but for whatever reason, that just stayed with me. So when usually, you know, hopefully the creative flow will hit in the daytime, and I'll usually try and record something on my iPhone, you know, just sing a little melody or do a little tinkle on the piano. But if it's at 3 in the morning, I kind of go, well, you know what, if it's still there in the morning, then it's probably meant to be. If not, well, that's okay. Another melody will come. So I'm pretty,
So have you got, like, heaps of songs written but you haven't performed yet?
Yeah, oh, yeah, totally. And I've forgotten most of them. You know, I'll, like, listen to little recordings, like demo recordings that I've done, and I'll go, wow, I honestly can't even remember writing that or performing that or playing that. I'm one of these people because I don't, for me, piano isn't a super, super natural instrument for me. I'm not a brilliant sort of pianist by any means, but
oh no, there's that word starting with P again.
Pianist.
Yes.
Oh, Eric, you're like 12 years old.
Yeah, I have a problem saying it because some people waves to Studio B. Some people think that sometimes it might come out wrong.
Like a penis.
Yeah.
It's a fine line. You've really got to sort of enunciate. Pianist.
And that's my problem.
Yeah, yeah. so, what was the question? Oh, forgotten.
Oh, we were talking about the process and how your songs come to mind and songs that you've written before and you haven't performed. And
oh, yeah, and I was talking about piano, and I think for me, like, I sort of, My brain can only hold so much sort of piano material. So as soon as I've got like 12 songs that are practiced in my head, it's like that's enough. Like remember at Stripped how you said, hey, play No, the song No.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I haven't practiced it. And for me, like it would have just kind of flown out the window because I really need to keep update, like practice all the time before I perform.
We should mention that because we tried to get you to sing the song No as part of your encore.
Yeah.
And you were treating that as if we didn't want you to perform.
Well, I think you were kind of, I walked back on for an encore and all I could hear was No! No! I thought, oh shit, like, I've done the wrong thing here. I misinterpreted. Maybe they're booing me. Oh, my God, this is heavy. But, in fact, Irk and Judy wanted to hear the song that was titled No.
Yeah.
You know, an easy mistake to make, Irk.
Yeah.
but yeah, I didn't actually even give it to you. I'm sorry. Because, yeah, I hadn't practiced it.
So how much practice do you do when you're not getting ready for a performance or a tour or anything like that?
Well, usually what I'll do is when I'm not getting ready for a tour, I don't really practice my songs. I usually use that time to create new songs and create new work. So I don't really practice old songs unless I'm just really in the mood, you know, to get, you know, a certain emotion out. Like I'm really angry, so I'll sit down and play No, or I'm in a reflective mood and I'll, you know, play Stuck in the Mud or whatever. So, yeah.
Do you find it funny when people quote your lyrics back to you and you're like,
Yeah, I've actually got a beautiful girl who's now turned into one of my friends called Nicole. Actually got one of my lyrics tattooed on her foot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's full on. That's a whole other level. So I was blown away by that. She got Is This Forever or Forever Just For Now? On her foot, which is a line from a song called Chai Tea from an earlier EP.
Off your current album, which we haven't really spoken a lot because we've sort of focused on the theatrical side, what's your favourite song off the current album?
I don't know. It changes. It really changes at the moment because I've just released Something That Can Hold and the film clip. I'm, you know, obviously very attached to that song and its meaning and... But sometimes it's Bigger Than You, Bigger Than Me. Other times it's Sincerely Fearful. Sometimes it's Stuck in the Mud. You know, I've generally got like, you know, four that are really kind of special to me. But it changes all the time. Depends on my mood.
Now, obviously for me, it was Sincerely Fearful, but what about the audiences? Is there anyone favourite of theirs?
I think, you know, Sincerely Fearful is definitely a favourite, generally speaking, yeah. And also Something That Can Hold as well. And then others like Stuck in the Mud. So it's a... But I think, generally speaking, Sincerely Fearful.
Tell me about Sincerely Fearful. Tell the audience, what's the story?
Well, it's really just a song that I wrote about facing my fears, and sometimes wanting to be someone else, sometimes just wanting to go, hey, this is too hard, I'm going to become someone else, I'm going to become Gwenda. which is, you know, the chorus lyrics are, could you fade me in, could you fade me out, could you fade me in if I'm not in doubt, could you lie to me, could you call me Gwenda, and could we just pretend, we just pretend. So initially I had in my head, sometimes I get these little images that flash up when I'm writing, I had this image of this giant volume knob, and I had like, could you fade me in? So it's kind of like testing the waters. Are they going to like who I am? Oh, okay, they don't like me. Could you fade me out? Okay, I'm going to put the mask back on. Okay, fade me in again if I'm not in doubt. Yeah, that's sort of where I had it. Maybe that doesn't make sense to anyone else, but it makes sense in my head.
You might have to watch the video. The video might make a bit more sense.
But there's no giant volume knobs in the video, but there are ninjas, and that... is something.
Did you come up with the idea of the video?
No, actually, originally it was something completely different, which I sort of had, it was, you know, something very similar to our original Imaginary Friends stage show, because Dale used to play a character called Gwenda until that character turned into Dr. Drake. So that's sort of where it all started. But actually, Johnny Williams, who was the director of the video, came up with the concept of ninjas. And so that was his baby, and he did such a brilliant job with that. So, yeah, and he also did the Something They Can Hold film clip as well.
So how long would it have taken to produce that film clip? Because it was quite full on with all the ninjas and you and...
To produce it, it was a whole day, like a full day from, you know, 11 till midnight or something like that. But then, of course, like we had to get costumes and find the ninjas and all of that kind of stuff, which takes, you know, it's probably like a month or 2 months preparation kind of beforehand. And then the post-production, that took a while. That took months as well. But yeah, the shooting time, it's just a day. And same with Something That Can Hold film clip, just a day.
So it was quite an awesome video. It's on your website, so if people want to go to emmadean.com check out the video. It sort of reminds me of a comic book / anime sort of feel.
With the on-screen
graphics and everything like that.
Totally. And Johnny actually lived in Japan for like a number of years, and so he's got that kind of Japanese kind of anime kind of leanings, I suppose. And yeah, comic book. Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head.
And so that would have been a lot of fun dressing up as a ninja and just basically mucking around and also doing the shoot as well. There was a lot of choreography in it as well. And
yeah, totally. Physical. But do you think that was me? Do you think all the ninjas were me? Do you think I did all those tricks?
Oh, of course it was you.
I really hope that you do, because I hope people do, because that would be cool. But unfortunately, yeah, it was actually all those tricks were performed by professional stunt men and women. Isn't that cool?
Do not... In the new version of the video clip, do not try this at home. These are trained ninjas.
Exactly. I should have had that flashing up on the screen for sure. Because some of the things they did were just crazy. Because what they wanted to do was to get some shots for their showreel as well. So in between takes, they'd actually be going, okay, we're going to try this crazy stunt where I'm going to flip and fall onto my back without a mattress. You know, and I'd be like, oh, my God. And so Johnny would be filming this, you know, stuff for their showreel because, you know, we didn't have enough money to pay them, so that was kind of like the trade-off.
Yeah.
And I'd be just, like, standing there going, oh, my God, they're going to die. But, of course, they didn't die and they were just really, really good. But, yeah, so interesting day.
Yes, I can imagine it would be. Now, I've sort of gone backwards. Normally I start with the how did you get into music question, but I thought we'll do all the other sort of stuff first. So how did you get into music in the first place?
I started at a music school called the Stoliarski School of Music when I was 2 in Brisbane, and kind of, you know, would attend classes when I was like on the weekend, and kind of had a pretty intense childhood with, you know, juggling music and dance and school, you know, and all these various things that I was doing. And I think it was when I was 6 or 5, I started violin, and obviously have had a very passionate love affair with the violin and still do, but I'm very, very, very out of practice, and I sort of was kind of known as the violin girl for a really long time, and I got my A-mus on the violin. And then somewhere along the line, I started learning piano, but I never took that seriously at all. I've got grade 1 piano, that's all I have, AMEB. And somewhere along the line, I obviously went through that teenage kind of angsty phase, and but more than that, I kind of was a very, very, very shy teenager and only really kind of let loose and spoke to a very select few friends. And really, like, I remember the first couple of years of high school, I really honestly found it very difficult to talk to anyone because I was just so painfully shy and so unsure of myself. So I would find myself kind of being, you know, locking myself away in my room and writing these songs that were sort of my little cries, my little voice. And this is how, you know, it was like I was starting a diary entry, but through music. And then the dreams of just being a famous pop star started to happen, and all my life I thought I'd be like this violinist, you know, in an orchestra. And so I formed a band with 2 very good friends, and it all, that's, you know, that's where it started for me. And then after high school, I decided to sort of end my intense study on the violin and focus on vocals. And I went to the Conservatorium of Music in Queensland and studied vocals there. And of course met some wonderful people and made some great connections and started my first originals duo called Bittersweet. And we toured around and had a really great following, especially in Brisbane. And then, of course, there was that time when it was just time for me to go solo, and that was in 2005. And since then, you know, I've been, honing my sound and my skills, and here I am. So that's it.
Have you found over the time that you've grown? It sounds like you've really grown from when you were that teenager in your bedroom to what you are now.
Yeah, I'm still an incredibly shy person, but through my stage experience, I think I've sort of most of the time sort of managed to overcome that, but still, you know, there's that little voice inside that's like petrified, because I mean, shyness is a really hard thing to sort of overcome, isn't it?
It is.
But you know, lots of people will, of course, say, "Oh, you don't seem shy at all. You seem really confident and sure of yourself." But that's often a little trick. But of course, performing on stage has definitely helped. Help that. But yes, I have grown a lot in the last 10 years, and I'm still growing, you know, as a performer, always growing and always wanting to learn new things and always wanting to push myself to, you know, outside of my comfort zone as a musician and as a performer. And so currently my interest is in that physical theatre and is in, you know, those theatrics. And my next venture after this tour is to perform as Sally Bowles in Cabaret, in the next sort of Australian, you know, professional version of Cabaret. So I'm, heading in that direction, and that feels right at this moment.
So that's the next thing on the radar. Is that the goal that you're trying to reach at the moment? Is that the burning desire?
As in being in a musical?
Yeah.
No, it's not. It's funny. It's sort of it's definitely exactly where I need to be right now. But in terms of my burning goal, I'm still trying to articulate that, I think. And I think that's why at this particular point I'm trying all of these things. And I think after Cabaret, I'm going to take a little bit of time to actually start to articulate what exactly it is that I want. Because I know that, you know, I want to be on stage, and I know that I want to be performing my original songs. But I think I've got to, you know, now take time to strip back and to sort of take the parts that I really, really want and start to form like a really solid goal for myself. So that's that.
So I noticed that you mentioned the word strip there. I don't know if that was deliberate or not, but you've gone from the Imaginary Friends tour, and then you've gone into your one-woman show, Stripped, that I recently saw at King's Cross.
Yeah.
That would have been very, very different for you. Tell the audience about the process of Stripped and what that was in aim of.
Well, Stripped for me was about, as I said, stripping back the layers. For me, I guess the layers were having other musicians on stage and having other, not just musicians, but performers on stage, and being just there by myself, just me and a piano, and feeling really, really, really vulnerable for the first time in a little while, because you find that, you know, you tend to rely on the other performers a lot. And it's a totally different skill to perform solo, when if you stuff up, you have to save yourself. You can't just rely on the performer to kind of come in and do something funny and cover it up, you know? So for me, it was creating a show that still had my theatrical element, but simply was one woman standing on the stage doing her thing. And so that was obviously quite a challenge to come up with that. How do you make it as big and theatrical as, you know, as the audience are used to and know you for, but, you know, only have one person and a dummy.
And a dummy.
Yeah, because I had, yes, a mannequin called Jane, who was a little bit of a diva, might I just say.
Very demanding, was she?
She was very demanding. You should have seen her rider. It was like, you know, two bottles of red wine, bourbon, yeah, all sorts of things. but yeah. So that was the aim.
I find it very difficult now to imagine you on stage, no theatrics at all. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of not me, isn't it? Yeah. Like I am a theatrical person in everyday life, you know? So I mean, define theatrics. I mean, yeah, there will always probably be a theatrical flair to what I do, even if it's just in the hand gestures that I make or the weird faces that I pull or my banter in between songs, you know, it'll always be a little bit theatrical. So I can't really imagine it myself either.
Is overseas part of the agenda?
Yeah, definitely. I think I will be going to New York at some stage, but after Cabaret, my life is a little bit of a question mark. So, you know, I don't really know where I'll be living and I don't know what's on the cards, and as like I think that's exactly where I need to be at the moment, to leave myself open for the universe to come to the party, you know.
Now, so, we said earlier that you're a Brisbane girl. You're currently living in Sydney. Was it a big adjustment?
Yeah, it was. Of course, it definitely was. You know, especially little things like in Brisbane, if you need a favour from someone, you know exactly who to call, you know, because as an independent artist, a lot of what we do, you do favours for someone and they give you a favour back. It may be, you know, they might record a live set of yours or they may do a film clip for you. And suddenly I had that pool of beautiful creative people who kind of were a creative team for me and we helped each other out. Suddenly I didn't have them and I had to sort of create a new community and a new creative team. And that took a really long time. And it's still, you know, God, you know, it's still not complete. So yeah, I do really love Sydney. But I am moving back to Brisbane for 3 months while I do Cabaret. And then, as I said, I've got no idea where I'll be, if I'll move back to Sydney or what. So, yeah.
How have you found the Brisbane music scene compared to Sydney or compared to Melbourne?
Well, I can't comment on Melbourne because I've never lived there. Brisbane has a thriving musical scene with incredible talent. And, you know, some bands and artists are doing really well, you know, on a national level and, you know, touring overseas, and it's so great to see. However, for me, I found that there weren't really enough venues to support what I was trying to do. There are lots of big venues in Brisbane and lots of kind of really, really small venues that are kind of suited for that indie kind of music. But for me, I couldn't really, you know, there's the old museum, which I play at, and that's kind of really the only place that I'm aware of for me to kind of play. And I found that what I was trying to do was kind of quite different to you know, what some of the other artists were trying to do. And I felt that I needed to go somewhere else at that time. But that was just, you know, my personal choice, and it was just because of the music that I create. But in Sydney, I think just because the population is bigger and there are more venues to cater for artists like me who do something a little bit out of the box, you know, I found it a little bit easier here. But of course, I'm still building a following, and that takes time as well. But yeah, I mean, so much talent in Australia in general, really, isn't there?
There is.
Yeah.
And just on that, in case anyone hasn't heard my last episode, last Friday, episode 149, I actually featured a Brisbane showcase of 17 separate artists.
Awesome. Who did you feature?
There's a lot of people, and some of them, actually, I was very surprised to find. Regurgitator, for instance, they're on there.
Awesome.
Because I got an email from the people who actually introduced you to me, SGC Media, who we should also say hi to.
Hello.
they sent me a lot of songs, and some of the tracks that I had, Regurgitator, they've been around for quite some time, and so as a indie podcaster, I was very surprised that I'd be, you know, sent them. For instance, I Heart Hiroshima, My Fiction, Regurgitator, Lawrence English, The Medics, The Good Ship.
Unreal.
And so if anyone hasn't heard that, go back to episode 149 and you'll be able to hear all of those from Brisbane.
That's fabulous. Wonderful.
So that indeed is quite cool, of course. So you're also very active online, Facebook, Twitter, social networking, trying to build your fan base.
That's right, yeah. My Facebook is Emmadine Music, and my Twitter is twitter.com/EmmaDean83. So join.
Yes, indeed. You found that very handy to interact with your fans and get people to the shows and that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, it's you know, it's free promo, and it's I think you kind of just have to have it, don't you, these days? But yeah, still building the fans on Facebook, you know. So I'd love to, you know, by the end of the year, have lots more. But yeah, it's great.
Have you found that if you, let's say you have a show, like your show's coming up and you put out an event saying, hey, I'm going to be at this venue, do you find all these people in the audience that you recognise based on how you've interacted with them online?
Yes, I do. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult because people will come up, you know, expecting that I know them. And often in your little profile photos on Facebook, you know, it's not always the best photo. And people tend to look a little bit different in real life than they do, obviously, on their little profile shots.
And it's often not them on their photo either.
Exactly. So they kind of come up expecting that we're, you know, very good friends. And I have not a clue who they are, but you know, that's to be expected. That's just normal. But it is certainly such a wonderful tool to keep in touch with fans and to like find out, you know, what they think of your show or what songs you should perform in the show and do little surveys on them and get interactive which I think is a big thing now. So, yeah.
And, of course, my Facebook photo and also my Twitter photo, I keep on getting asked, who is that hottie with Irk?
Oh, really? Oh, I like that.
I do.
Excellent. Well, I now look completely different because I've just had to chop my hair to like a very straight, severe bob and dye it black because I am playing Sally Bowles.
Yep.
So now you won't recognize me probably when you next see me.
Wow.
Yeah. It's on actually, I've put up a photo on Facebook, so check it out.
So what is your natural colour anyway? Because I'm used to seeing the bright red and...
Yeah, it's the same colour as my brother, really. It's kind of blonde, like that dark sandy blonde.
Yeah, awesome. So you can check out Emma, of course, emmadean.com, and check her out on Facebook as well, Emma Dean Music, and the Twitter as well. So you're quite open for a chat.
That's right, of course, always.
Awesome. So, Emma, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on IRC FM. Good luck with the tour. You'll have to let us know how we go. And also, I dare say that I'll be talking about it at some length, especially on Blast from the Past. I know that we've talked about a couple of your shows on that weekend show here on Channel IRC.
Yes. Awesome. Blast from the Past. I like it.
Awesome. So, ladies and gentlemen, the wonderful Emma Dean, hopefully coming soon to a place near you if you're in Australia, but if not, there's videos online as well, so if people sort of want to get some of the experience from overseas, they can look as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Irk. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Absolutely. So, that's episode 150 with my very special guest, Emma Dean. What am I going to do to beat that for 200? I've got no idea. But that's in about 50 episodes' time, so I've got lots of time to think about it. Don't forget to check me out on Friday for the regular Friday show, episode 151, a wide selection of independent and unsigned music from around the world coming down the pipes and into your ears on Friday. But until then, on behalf of Emma and myself, it's good night, Interweb. I just can't live without it. I just can't live without it. I am sincerely fearful of the voices in my head that tell me, honey, make your mind up, we're giving you the wind up, little lady. I am sincerely fearful of the choices that I face, should I show you what's under the wrapping? There could be something lacking. Could you fade me in? And could you fade me out? And could you fade me in if you're not in doubt? And could you lie to me? And could you call me Gwenda? And could we just pretend? And could we just pretend? I just can't live without it. I just can't live without it. Sincerely fearful. I've admitted and I'm afraid, so I think I'll try to blow your brains out. Hope I can get the stains out and say this never happened. I am sincerely fearful of the truth that I will face, so I think I'll get liposuction, Botox, or breast reduction. Could you fade me in? And could you fade me out? And could you fade me in if you're not?
shelf. I'm not under the rug. I'm not behind the curtain. I keep on losing myself. So I'm filling up the hole by filling up my holes. And I don't know if I will be seen again. Yes, I don't know if I will be seen. Will be seen. Doctor, doctor, and won't you please? Like a slut, 'cause don't people like sluts? And I don't know if I will be seen again. Yes, I don't know if I will be seen. Will be seen. Doctor, doctor, won't you please help me? I'm swollen and tearing at the seams. I'm broken. Won't you make this right? I'll make it worth your while if you let me.
Has a name, and hers will be so.